Welcome to Holy Unhappiness, conversations about the expectations we have of what the life of faith will feel like. I'm your host, Amanda Held Opelt, author of the book Holy Unhappiness, God, Goodness, and the Myth of the Blessed Life. Each week, I'll be speaking with writers, pastors, artists, and friends about the myths we believe about the good life. Together, we'll reimagine what blessing can look like if we are willing to look beyond our culture's definition of happiness and success. Welcome. I'm glad you're here. Welcome back. We are on week three of Advent, a week where the church traditionally meditates on the experience of joy. This is the week where we light the pink candle in the Advent wreath and look with anticipation to the celebration of Christmas and the 12 days that follow up to Epiphany. Now, something I've been thinking a lot about is how the Christmases of my youth were always filled with this sense of magic and wonder and mystery, and it can be really hard to recapture some of those feelings as an adult. But I think the yearning to control that often comes with aging and becoming an adult, the need to understand, the need to have a systematized explanation for everything from the incarnation to Santa Claus, this can actually be a real hindrance to the joy, the unbridled awe and wonder that we are all really longing for deep down. And so to talk about this loss of wonder and this recapturing of joy, I've brought on a friend and an artist who talks about wonder and awe as well as anybody I've ever known. Corey Fry is a multidisciplinary artist, poet, and art educator living in Maryland. In addition to his personal creative practice, Corey is the exhibitions manager at the Della Plain Art Center in Frederick, Maryland, and is one of the leaders in the Breath and the Clay Creative Arts Conference and the Makers and Mystics Creative Collective. He and his wife, Christy, founded the Well Collaborative, a community in Maryland that values creativity, curiosity, and conversations about art, humanity, faith, and culture. Stay tuned for a great conversation. Corey, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. I'm really excited to talk to you.
Oh my gosh, I'm very excited to be here. I appreciate you and the invite. So,
we probably met at the Breath and the Clay conference last year. Would have been when we met, and I brought my notebook that I had at the Breath and the Clay when you talked. I have so many notes from your, like, it was like a 10-minute talk, right? It wasn't that long.
It might have been 15 or so. Who knows? I probably pushed the limits of my time. So,
it was chock full of incredible things. I'm just going to read a couple snippets that I wrote down. You asked us the question, is the work you are creating as weird as you are? As curious and conflicted and ambivalent as you are? I loved that question. And the other thing you said is, if you want to make religious art, make art that wrestles with God. Honor the name of his people, Israel, he who struggles with God. And so I knew when I heard you talk, I knew him. I'm like, this guy, like, every time he opens his mouth, he says something really, like, that really convicts me and challenges me and inspires me. And then we met again at this writer's retreat that Breath and the Clay and Makers and Mystics put on. And once again, you got up there kind of like humbly and like you weren't even sure if you should be saying, and you just, it was like so good. So I was like, I you're actually the reason I decided to revive the podcast for Advent. Cause I was like, I got to have Corey on the podcast. Oh, but that means I got to do an Advent series.
Oh my gosh. You're too kind. That's very kind of you.
Well, I think artists kind of share a kindred spirit. Like, you're an artist. And I think we kind of share that kindred spirit. I wonder, I didn't send you this question in advance, but I wonder if you can remember when you were a kid, like, when did you know you were an artist, that this was your work?
Well, I mean, as a kid, I loved drawing all the time, and I actually put it aside for quite a while. And it wasn't until like my late 20s, really, that it was revived in my heart. It kind of is this latent possibility. And I remember kind of feeling, the only way I know how to talk about it is I was in a bit of a despondent place in my life, not sure which way to go. And I remember feeling a whisper, not necessarily hearing a whisper, but feeling the whisper of, "Don't you remember how as a kid you loved drawing?" And it was an out of the blue moment, like, this doesn't really help me with the logistical day to day of my life, but I've got to follow this bit, you know, this ember and stoke it a little bit. And so, so it was really revived kind of in my late 20s a bit more. And I threw myself headlong into it.
Yeah. Well, and that's actually a great way to introduce my first question for you, because I think there's something about the artist that has to maintain a childlikeness, that has to kind of remember kind of the abandoned awe and wonder of childhood and the imagination and the imaginatory work of childhood, which is something we've kind of lost in this modern age. Not just lost as we've gotten older, like lost as we've gotten older as a society, I guess, is lost as time has gone by, history has unfolded. So the question I want to ask you, and there's a reason I'm asking this, you talked about this a little bit at the writers' conference, is why do you think people in our day and age struggle so much with mystery? I mean, call it modernity, call it, you know, modern American life. Like, why do people struggle with mystery? What's the discomfort there?
I don't know. We're kind of swimming in the waters of some pretty strong currents, historical currents, that have as their value system something. This is hard to talk about because I don't know that it's necessarily antithetical to wonder, but there is something about the scientific revolution and industrial revolution that ramps up to this certain point, like a culmination in history, that I think we're feeling the reverberations of, and the Enlightenment movement too, that the value system of the scientific revolution, well, of the industrial revolution, is numbers, and the value system of the Enlightenment is sort of understanding. The scientific revolution is like understanding as well, and the problem that I foresee with that is, like, if you just think about the word understanding, like, you're standing under something, your intelligence is supposed to buttress or like support this idea, this hefty monolithic idea. And I just don't think that humanity's meant for only that kind of intelligence. I think that we are meant for, again, language that I'm not entirely sure if I subscribe to, but there's sort of this revolution. I'm a little hesitant about the word revolution, of maybe it's just a revitalization of intuitive intelligence and emotional intelligence that artists kind of contend with. Yeah, I guess what I really think about it is that, you know, St. Paul said it in that we see through a glass darkly. And he's saying two things simultaneously when he says that. He's saying that we know things and we don't know things. And so ignorance, really, like, we've got to come to grips with our own ignorance.
Yeah.
And I think the more and more we uncover things, even in the efforts of science and in the efforts of the Enlightenment, we're recognizing that there's still a deficiency, because we're not maintaining an equilibrium of what it means to be human. We're throwing everything to one side of intelligence, and we're kind of abandoning the other. And so there does seem to me to be sort of this, it's as if we're, we're going to the physical therapist in the body of humanity, and we're learning how to exercise a musculature that has atrophy to it. And so the demand from a physical therapist is that you relinquish some control of your strength in order to grow. It's not so that there's a supplanting of strength. It's that there's an equilibrium so that we're a whole body. So that's a long-winded maybe answer to your question, but did I answer it? You did.
And I think there's something about the way that we interact with the world today where a mystery and maybe not fully understanding something, something not being fully clear, it leaves us maybe more feeling more insecure or more fearful or more surprised and shocked than it used to, right? It's like, because it's this trajectory that we're on is that we're progressing in our understanding. We're growing in our understanding. And so I think where there are things like theological tensions or paradox in scripture, the God man, like the most beautiful paradox of our faith in many ways, it's harder to kind of sit with and even adore the paradox because we feel threatened by it in this world today. You know, we're supposed to understand, we're supposed to be able to explain this in more scientific terms or quantitative terms, that like we're supposed to be able to explain this fully. And when we can't, we feel like, well, then we must be missing something, or maybe it's not worth putting our trust in if we can't understand it or explain. Does that make sense?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, one thing that's interesting to me is that, and I hate talking like this because I'm very grateful for my upbringing and I actually really hold on to it, you know, but one of the problems of Western evangelicalism.
We could talk about its problems here, Corey. We love it. We critique it. We do all those things here.
Yeah, it's necessary. You know, I just want to state at the outset that I'm grateful, you know.
Totally.
But one of the problems is that we've turned the gospel into only a message to be proclaimed. And when we say that it's the good news, we kind of mean that it's our modern understanding of news. Mm-hmm. And our modern understanding of news is reducing things down to the most simplest form so that we can convey things in a concise way. Yeah. And it just wasn't that way in the time when it was considered good news. Good news in Jesus' time was storytelling, and there's complexity. There, it's like word of mouth, people telling stories. It's that game. Maybe it's even as messy as that game of telephone where you would whisper something to one person, whisper it to the next, and it would change over time.
Yeah.
This is more of a messy thing, and here's what it requires. It requires trust and and that requires risk. Mm. And we're very uncomfortable with both trust and risk because we're bearing the weight of the responsibility of a more modern understanding of good news that I have to, everything has to be laid out and plain and simple. And to go back to sort of the resurgence of creativity in this sort of thing is that the job of the artist in some way is to reintroduce complexity into things that have been overly simplified. Yeah. And James Baldwin, this is my favorite quote, I think, in the whole world, is James Baldwin said that the purpose of art is to reveal the questions that are hidden by the answers. And so like there's this necessity for wonder in order for us to be whole human beings again. And I think we're feeling the weight of that and responding a little bit.
Yeah. Which this conversation I think is so appropriate for Advent, because that to me, you know, I talk about this in the Advent introduction that it, you know, Advent didn't used to be a time of frivolity and, you know, celebrating. It used to be this very contemplative season of fasting before Christmastide. And so it was marked by darkness and penitence and kind of meditating on Israel's, you know, waiting for the Messiah for generations and generations, meditating on our own waiting for the second coming, which is really just sitting in the unknown. When is Christ coming? When is our salvation coming? When, When is our hope finally going to arrive? And man, people endured for a really long time. And I don't know, that is a muscle that has atrophied. This patience with the unknown has atrophied. We want that simple, clear, here's what to expect. Here's what Jesus is going to do for you. And here's when he's going to do it. Like, that's what we want. And we don't have that. We don't have that. That's not life.
Yeah. And this strikes me as really pertinent to the conversation, especially regarding paradox and needing to endure the unknown within paradox, is that, you know, Christ's life begins and ends with two seemingly contradictory statements. And that's that the angel tells Joseph that they will call him Emmanuel, God with us. But then at the end of Jesus's life, he resurrects, and the people that are thrilled with his resurrection, he looks at them and says, it's better for you that I go. And so there's this paradox of like, God with us, but it's better that I go. Mm-hmm. And so if we only hold on to kind of surface level, I think there are, this might be a good way to think about a couple of the things that we'll talk about tonight, but I think that there are deep principles at work in our lives, and there are surface level correlatives that if they're removed from the root system of the deep principle, then they look antagonistic to one another. Mm-hmm. And something like that might be that nearness and distance are actually surface level correlatives that can exist together and thrive off of one another if they're rooted in presence. Mm-hmm. And so God will actually, you know, you can be near to somebody and still be estranged from them. God is so full of grace that he wants more from us than just nearness. And he'll actually distance himself from us for the sake of growing presence in our life. And so it is better for you that Jesus leaves, that you don't have a man on the earth. I would love at times to have Jesus by my side. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it requires some kind of a trust to say, like, it's actually better for you that I go. He doesn't just finish. Like, that's one part of it. He says, it's better for you that I go, because then the advocate, the Spirit, will come. But the Spirit's like a wind. The Spirit is pneuma. It's breath. You don't know where it's going. You don't know where it's coming from.
Why would you leave the most mysterious, like,
totally,
you know, branch of the Trinity behind for us? Like, this one's hard to pin down, the Spirit. You're exactly right, you know?
Yeah. As you're waiting for me for this unknown amount of time, I'm going to give you this thing that is also unknown and unpredictable, but it's also the thing that at the beginning of the story is hovering over dark waters, mm-hmm. Over the potential of dark waters. And it's the thing that it's also the thing isn't the right way to say it. It's the person or the, you know, the member of the Trinity where deep calls to deep. It resides in deep places, and deep doesn't call to shallow, deep calls to deep. And so there's this sense that well here's the other thing, is that when Jesus says that the Spirit will come, in another place he says the Spirit will remind you of all the things that I've had to say. And we all know, like, remembering through Advent, through the practice of Advent, through the practice of the Eucharist, do this in remembrance of me. Mm-hmm. This is not a system where God is only speaking to you and demanding of you. This is a pairing of the Spirit of God with your mind, with your soul. Like, it will remind you of all the things that I've said. And that's a working of the mind and this entity. There's a reciprocal sort of relationship there. And that has the possibility, that has more of a possibility of presence rather than just nearness.
Yeah. But even as we're talking, I'm mindful of how actually uncomfortable these types of conversations are in our modern world. Like, these are the deep things of God, and they're actually, we almost lack a language for it. And we certainly lack a comfort, I think, with the language and this language of mystery, which again is why I think the artist's work is the prophetic work. It is it's often called the prophetic work. It's also the pastoral work. It's the it's so important. And I want to talk a little bit about, well, I want to talk about joy. Joy is the theme of this week of Advent. And yeah. I wonder sometimes if you see a correlation between this loss of capacity for mystery, comfort for with mystery, and a loss of joy. Do you see that correlation or a relationship there?
I honestly, I kind of chuckled a little bit when I found out that I was doing the joy part of Advent, because, and I was telling a friend of mine that was at the writer's retreat. I was like, yeah. I'm going to be on Amanda's podcast and we're going to talk about joy. And he kind of laughed too, because I'm kind of a melancholy guy. Like I actually have come to grips with longing being like a real necessary part of my life. And I've dealt with shame about that a lot of my life, but I've actually come to recognize it as there's real potential for relationship with the divine and longing. And
this is why you're chosen, Corey. This is why you're chosen.
And what it's holy unhappiness, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's the name totally of the podcast, man.
Good grief. I mean, yeah, when I saw that, it was like, oh man, yes, Amanda is my people. Where was I going with that? Oh yeah, mystery and joy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, since I found out that we were going to be talking about joy, I'm still not even sure how I feel about the word joy. This is another one of these things that I think this rubric of deep principle and surface level correlatives actually is helpful, because it seems to me that joy is another one of these deep principles, and the surface level correlatives are happiness and sadness, and they seem antagonistic to one another if they're uprooted from the deep principle. But if they're rooted in the deep principle, man, melancholy and even sadness and grief are all a part of joy. There's capacity within joy. It's large enough to house those sorts of things. And that's beautiful. But I've struggled to actually answer your question. You know, I just don't know about joy. The thing is like, it seems to me to be the result of like, of the right kind of orientation. Mm-hmm. And Jesus, when he talks about, there's that amazing passage where he's talking about the vine and the branches. I'm mm-hmm. the vine and you are the branches, like this whole thing. But he says, I've told you these things so that your joy will be complete. So that my joy will be complete in you. That's what he says.
Yeah.
My joy will be complete in you. And joy is also a fruit of the Spirit. And I remember a pastor saying one time, like, that a tree, like a fruit tree's things just need to be oriented in the right way in order for it to produce fruit. A tree isn't struggling to produce fruit. It's that all the recipe's right for everything that needs to be there. And so it seems to me that, again, to come back to the part of the recipe for being a human being is a lack of understanding. And wonder necessitates this lack of understanding that we know and we don't know at the same time. And so when maybe it's something like when that recipe's right, when that orientation is right and it's rounded out in the right way, yeah. then joy becomes a natural product of it. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Oh, no. I mean, I think that's so true. And I talk a lot. I write about this a bit in my book about that, you know, following Christ, walking in the way of Jesus is not, it doesn't promise happy outcomes in the sense that it doesn't promise we're going to have like the life we always wanted or be comfortable, healthy, wealthy, all those things. What I do think is true about the way of Jesus, and it's a narrow way. is that it creates that walk, that way creates an environment that is conducive to wholeness. It creates an environment that is conducive to joy, you know, conducive to thriving. Now, and thriving not just for me, it creates a condition that's thriving where my neighbor can thrive as well, because I'm interested in my neighbor's thriving as much as I'm interested in my mind. That is what walking with Jesus does. It's not a promise of health or wealth. It is a creator of an environment that creates that wholeness, and joy is part of that. But grief can also be part of wholeness. I think no grief indicates that there is not wholeness. Something's missing if there's no grief. If you cannot look at the world, if you look at the world and you're not grieved, if you look at the world and you're not have sorrow or even despair from time to time, if you look at your life and you don't have repentance, if you look at your life and the world around you and all you have is a sense of happiness and everything's fine, then something's dramatically missing.
The agricultural model is such a great model for humanity, because of course he's going to come up in any conversation, but Uncle Wendell Berry, he talks about how anything that has organic life has both growth and decay, and so there are cycles of growth and decay. And so if you're a living human being and you're not undergoing, you're always undergoing some sort of growth and some sort of decay. And that's something to grieve about and praise about at the same time. And so both of those things are great possibilities. They're not antagonistic to one another. They are great possibilities within the confines of like abundant joy. I love what you're saying about that, Amanda. It's great.
Do you feel that rage and righteous indignation are kind of maybe taking up a disproportionate amount of space in our discourse now? And maybe that's for good or bad. I don't know. We were having a conversation before we hit record about just like, we're in a post-election season and there's a lot of feelings. There's lots of feelings. And I'm just wondering, I think there's been a lot of conversation lately about the role that rage has to play in the prophetic work. And I think that's really healthy. I think it's been healthy to name that like righteous indignation, rage has a role to play. And also I worry a bit about the disproportion. And I wonder if joy also has a role to play in the prophetic work.
Yeah. A couple of thoughts come to mind. So yeah, the prophets, poor Jeremiah, he's got a fire. It's called a fire in his bones, and he almost doesn't want it. It seems as if, but he's compelled, and he has no converts. Like there's no success. There's no industrial value success for poor Jeremiah.
Yeah,
and so he's not exactly the most happy person, I would imagine. I mean, he's writing things like Lamentations, right? And so grief is there, and I can only imagine that he had there was a simultaneity with joy for him. But I feel like the jury's out whether our indignation is righteous or not. And so I think time will tell a little bit about that. And the other thing is that there's a great poet named Jack Gilbert. He has a poem called A Brief for the Defense. And he says, let me see if I can get this right. He says there's laughter every day in the streets of Calcutta. And he says to we must risk delight. And this is the kicker. And when I say it, there's like a hesitation with it almost. But he says, to make injustice the only aim of our attention is to praise the devil.
Wow.
And I feel a little bit like we're on that kind of route, as far as you saying disproportionate amount of rage. It feels that way a little bit. And I think the rising levels of cynicism are indicators of that. Mm-hmm. A cynic, I kind of don't know why I'm not a cynic, honestly. And cynicism, like, it has etymological hints at a group of Greek philosophers called the Cynics, and it actually meant dog, like mistreated dog. And the thing is like all of us, we're beaten up with life, and life is really challenging. And I say that from like I have lots of benefits in my life and beautiful things around me, but life is like really hard. And so it's no wonder to me that people are cynical, because life sucks sometimes and is really challenging. And we haven't been given good models of grief, like real grief, in order to cope with some of the difficulties that we have. We don't have, you know, we've lost things like memento mori, and we've lost like these things that help us cope with the difficulty of life. And so it's no wonder that people are cynical. Here's the other thing, is that you can't form an identity. Like, you can't have an identity formed around what you're against.
Yeah.
Around only what you're against. And again, we haven't been given good models, because like, here we go again, but like Protestantism, like the word Protestantism means protest. It's defined by what it's against in some ways. Mm-hmm. And we've got to deal with that. We've got to repent and figure out how to repent of that and deal with it in good ways. And I think like figuring out how to grieve well is one of those ways. Figuring out wonder is one of those ways. And it'll help us understand our belonging. And maybe when we've gotten a grip on some of our belonging to God, like maybe then our indignation can start to be leveraged towards righteousness. Yeah. But I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, I don't know either, Corey. That's why I had you on the podcast, to tell me all the answers. No, I'm joking. But I am thinking about like last Advent, Cole Arthur Riley came on. I think she talked about hope. But, you know, she is a person who writes a lot about injustice in the world and writes a lot about anger. But she talked about something she called artifacts of joy, where she, you know, as a Black woman, she has studied the history of the laughing barrel, where slaves would go and laugh into a barrel so that their laughter wouldn't be so loud that they would be reprimanded for it. And just this kind of insistence on joy as part of humanity, even when you are being dehumanized, and that is a physical artifact of joy, of taking a moment to say, well, I will not just fix my gaze on the injustice. I'm going to fix my gaze on beauty and my own humanity and the humanity of the people around me, and laugh and have joy. And I think about that a lot, because I do think that finding those artifacts of joy are a way that we can bring back. It is that equilibrium. It is that balance.
Yeah.
Which kind of leads me to the last few things I wanted to talk to you about, which is your role as an artist. Do you create artifacts of joy? What is the role of the artist in practicing that joy and mystery?
Well, I think for me, I think artists can actualize wonder in practice, but only if they're not like kind of bent on enforcing their idea. Like if you enforce an idea into the world, it's kind of propagandistic, but if you allow art to do what it does best and move in the poetic, then it's more open than that and allows for more possibility than just the thing that you're trying to enforce. And so it creates an openness for wonder, where wonder can kind of thrive. Yeah. But the other thing about it is that like, I think that artists sort of instantiate an understanding that God is curious about what humans have to say about the world. And so, you know, there's a lot of talk about reenchantment and the wonder of reenchantment. And I think that it's really lovely, but there does seem to be a missing part of the conversation. And that's that, like, And that's our participation in one, in creating wonder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I've always been struck by the beginning, the first encounter with humankind's creativity, where God, it says that God brought the animals to Adam to see what he would name them, to see. And I always think about my daughter. When my daughter was first born, I remember Christy, my wife, and I laying in bed, and Finley, our daughter, was in the room with us, you know, tiny. And I remember us like just kind of crying together and being like, I wonder what she's going to be like in the world. But also, I wonder what her little voice is going to be like.
Mm-hmm.
And when she started to speak, I was 30 some years old, and I had the accrual of all of my knowledge, every book that I've read, every song that I've heard, every class that I've been in, all of the accrual of all this understanding. And I knew that every time if I asked her, Finley, what's your favorite color? The answer was always going to be pink. And what's your favorite animal? Always unicorn. And all, the accrual of all my understanding. And I just wanted to hear how this child, like, through her mispronunciation and her jumbling of language, I just wanted to hear what she had to say about the world.
Yeah.
And I feel like that opened up an understanding of the curiosity of relational reciprocity with the divine.
Mm-hmm.
And so, gosh, how did I get off on all this? But it's that, artists instantiate an understanding that God is curious, that God's mm-hmm. looking. And to pull it back to Advent, maybe even, you know, God throughout the Old Testament is I am, and God's always going to be I am, but something changes with the incarnation where a new level of understanding of God is unfolded, and it goes, the new level of understanding goes from only I am to I am, but also who do you say that I am?
Mm-hmm.
And so Peter, like this is two people. Jesus isn't just trying to teach Peter a lesson, right? He's looking at his friend. He says, I've not just come to call you servants, but I've come to call you friends. And he's sitting across from Peter. And Peter, I mean, he's seeing the shadow on the left side of Christ's nose. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this relational reciprocity, and Jesus isn't just trying to teach him a lesson. He's saying, like, people are saying that I'm Elijah, people are saying this, but I wonder what you think about me, Peter.
Mm-hmm.
And to circle back to the role of the artist, I think that we can be kind of confident in this revelation, this unfolding revelation of who God is, with now Jesus not being here, but the Spirit being here, the inspiration, like Spirit inspire, I think is the Latin, like wind, breath. It's the same word. And I think now when, you know, if we can intuit the voice of God saying, who do you say I am? Artists can say, well, you know, let me show you something that I've been working on.
Mm.
And God's really interested in those things.
Yeah.
And so I think it instantiates the understanding that God's curious. And this is a level of wonder that I think that we need to grab onto as well, that wonder isn't just something we receive, but wonder is something that we can give. We can create wonder.
Mm-hmm.
And there's real potential in that. Did that answer your question at all?
Yes, and more and more.
Okay.
And
okay.
It may be at the risk of sounding cheesy, but like, what better time for creating wonder than Christmas? Like, I think it's like I actually love, gosh, we've got to habituate joy. We've got to ritualize joy. And I love that, like, we're kind of forced to do that at Christmas.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we, every year we're kind of forced by society. Like, you can call it consumerism, you can call it like the commercialization of Christmas, but I kind of love that we're forced to be festive for a while. We're forced to engage in conviviality for a while. Yeah. I actually think that's good for our souls. I think to have it on the calendar is actually really a beautiful thing, you know?
Yeah. People who would never sing will sing a Christmas carol.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, so I think that you're right. You're totally right. There is this sense of festivity. It's like it's something that bypasses our own insecurity about mm-hmm. things and maybe our grumpiness too. I don't know.
I don't know. I think that call me crazy, but this is, I love the season. Like, I love Christmas. I love Advent. I love the anticipation leading up to it. but I, this is so helpful. I love talking about I love what you said about like God's engagement with us. It went from I am to who do you say I am? And I think kind of to circle back around to what we talked about in the beginning, this paradox, this mystery of a dynamic, interactive God, like a God that would be moved by us, like a God that would, you know, kind of be emotionally engaged with us, that would display all these very human-like emotions as he engages with us, grief, joy, singing over us, that we might, the mystery that we might impact God in that way is really hard. I'm like, well, how do I square that with my view of God's sovereignty? How do I square that with my view of God's immutability? And you don't. Like, God is moved by us to some degree, and there's no explaining it. And it is a challenge for a modern, like fully modern minded person like me to be okay with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
that's
faith. That's faith. That's a life of faith.
Yeah, totally. I'm totally with you. And trust. And yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Well, Corey, before we say goodbye, would you be willing, you are a visual artist, also you're a poet. Would you be willing to read one of your poems for our listeners?
I'd really be honored to. So this is a pretty recent poem that I think fits what we're talking about. It's called At Times I Worry, But Then. At times I worry I've traded the heft of stones and that slowness, rushed out the mysterious rhythms of stridulation, the settling of dew, a core of warmth for cover, but then notice noticing and its grace, to know even the absence of a thing, the line of a fisherman and every felt flick's correspondence. How educated are his guesses, color, size, jerk, and place, how elaborate his reach from solid ground. My cheeks flush when I breathe in, and I cannot know this. I close my eyes and I imagine a depth. Is this housed somewhere? Light illuminating some iron and calcite? I have imagined no light, but follow a tone of regard, a sympathetic churn. A mockingbird's borrowed trill is first to my predicament. But this is no concession. This is what life is like.
To notice the absence. That's Advent.
Yeah,
that's what
so
we're
true.
Doing.
Yeah.
There's holiness in the waiting. There's holiness in feeling like God is far away sometimes.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Corey. Thank you for this conversation. Thank you for the poem. Thanks for coming on the podcast. Let's keep being friends, okay?
I would love that. Thank you for having me. I really mean it. That I feel just really honored to be here. And I do feel a camaraderie in you know what we're talking through. And so it's been fantastic.
Corey, where can people find you? I mean, you know, not necessarily knock on your actual physical door, but like online and stuff like that.
Well, if you want to come to my door, we could have dinner or something. But, oh gosh. So Corey S. Fry, and my last name is spelled F-R-E-Y. CoreySFry.com is my website that has a lot of my art, my visual artwork. And then I have a Substack called A Brusque Night's Crisp Morning, which is so hard to say. A Brusque Night's Crisp Morning. You can find that. I don't know how you find stuff on Substack, but it's there. You can search for that or probably my name too. And I post, I've got some essay stuff and post poems every once in a while. And so, those are some of the good places.
I'm really proud of you for promoting your Substack. I'm supposed to be doing that too.
Thank you.
It's hard work. Good job. You did a good job.
Oh, thanks.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for the chat and we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
Joy to the The Lord is come. Let earth receive her.